God's ways are higher than our ways, and we know that God's fullness is going to be greater than ours. So the only way we're going to be able to apprehend that is not in any totality, but we imagine fractures. And in my tradition, we'll often talk about the inbreaking kingdom of God. And so you have a tiny moment of the inbreaking kingdom of God, and you have a sense of it, and then it goes away. But that doesn't mean it wasn't perfect in that moment, because God's time is outside of our time too. So we have to engage with the imagination.
Kelly Keith Perry is Assistant Professor of Contextual Education and Public Theology at Boston College's School of Theology and Ministry. A traveling minister within the Religious Society of Friends, the Quakers, he's also the author of two books we discussed today, 2014's Way to Water, a Theopoetics Primer, and 2023's Sense of the Possible, an Introduction to Theology and Imagination. I'm Matthew Ickman of the BYU Faith and Imagination Institute. So, Khaled, welcome to BYU.
It's great to be here.
You know, we're meeting here in person, which is like unusual for us. And this is the studio, i.e. just a little seminar room that we're meeting. Not bad,
it's
though,
it's incredible.
Right?
All the gold is incredible.
As if, right? Don't say that. No, we don't have any gold in here. Actually, I will say that there is a studio on campus, a very nice recording studio up at BYU Media. Mm. And years ago, before we had this podcast and before I was even hosting anything like this, I used to once in a while interview guests for this radio program up there at BYU Media. And we had a guest once from New York. He walked in and said, "Man, this is nicer than NPR in New York City." And I thought, that's not saying that much.
You know? Okay. Well, you've got to get your standards calibrated.
That's right. Yeah. We do. That's right. Yeah. So you're in town for this conference in interfaith education we're having in the next couple of days. And you'll be speaking. And I'm speaking too. I'd rather hear you than hear myself
speak. You have to put up with your own voice, right?
I know you have to do. This is very true. Yeah. Are you speaking? Now, we're talking today about your book on the imagination. Are you speaking at the conference, but anything related to this, or is it a totally different subject?
Well, I don't really do anything that's totally different, but there's different emphases. So one of the kind of superficially reason I was kind of brought in is because I do work on, in formation, and I'm working at a Catholic institution, and I'm not Catholic. And before that, I was working at a Methodist institution, and I'm not Methodist. And before that, I was Baptist, and I'm not Baptist. So partly that, and also partly because of some of the particularities of the Religious Society of Friends, like, and there's so few of us, we often are adept at kind of ecumenical and oftentimes interfaith work. And then because it's my job to do formation, and both in my tradition and in what I do at Boston College at the present, we're doing ministerial formation in a way that doesn't mean they're going to be professional clergy. And I think there's some resonances there with the Church of Latter-day Saints. And so I think there was some overlap in people who had seen some of my work, I think had read some of my work, but also knew that I was doing formation and that that was my job. And I said, oh, this is a guy who probably knows how to talk about this increase in need for interfaith in faith-based colleges, but also recognizing that just because you're including conversations about difference doesn't mean you don't have your own home, right? And so I kind of just got contacted by some folk who are putting this together and say, hey, we think this is what you do. Is that right? And I said, that's right. Yeah. Here I am.
Well, it's good to have you here. I always enjoy talking to people who work in formation. I find them to be, among other things, very good listeners, are very sensitive people by and large, until today. I'm joking.
Well, you know, you're setting me up for a failure.
No, but I really appreciate the work you do in formation, and I'm looking forward to talking to you about the work here you're doing on the imagination. I want to begin, though, with before we get to your book on imagination, which is titled Sense of the Possible, I want to ask you about the previous book you published, the provocatively titled Way to Water, and subtitled A Theopoetics Primer. And that book takes up theopoetics, which, as you clarify in the book, does not mean poetry about God. It's poetics, rather, is like a form of rhetorical construction. It's how we talk about God, how we talk in theology about God. And as you remark there, I'm quoting you here, at the heart of this book is the belief that how we articulate our experiences of the divine can alter our experience of the divine. So I'm going to begin with a chicken and egg question here. And I know it's chicken and egg, but I'm just curious how you would articulate your answer to this. In your experience studying theology and in your own spiritual life, is it truer to say that how we articulate our experience of God affects how we then experience God? Or does the experience we have of God precede and affect our articulation of that experience? I mean, both things can be true. I'm wondering, though, if you were kind of organizing, ordering them for yourself as what you observe, does one take precedence over the other?
Yeah, so I tend not to think about these as either or. They're actually nested, right? So our experience of language is experience of God. It's just particular, right? So I'm very much kind of in the camp that recognizes what kind of theologians call natural theology. That is to say, there's something to learn about God and the Holy Ghost in the midst of the thingness of the world, right? The stuff we see around us, natural world and human creation. There's still some mark or trace of God's work in the midst. And so to say, well, which one's first is to actually dismiss the fact that, in fact, it's all part of kind of God's work, especially God's work via the Holy Spirit, and everything can be reconciled into that. So I recognize that those are different things conceptually, but I actually don't think about them as chicken or egg. You know, they're both deeply connected. And it's interesting, you know, because I still teach this book, but that book was written more than a decade ago now. Yeah. And increasingly, when I teach, this semester I'm teaching my imagination course, and when I talk about theopoetics, I don't emphasize the written word off the bat anymore. I talk about how poesis in Greek is just one of the verbs for making, and the difference between there's another one, praso. And so in Greek, and if I said to you, hey, did you make your bed this morning, and you said yes, you prosoed your bed. But if I said, did you poesis your bed? That means, did you create a bed this morning?
Yeah, right.
Right. Did you make a bed this morning? Yeah. And so what's interesting about that is once you know the difference between like the making and the making, you realize that poesis is a kind of creative making that is about novelty, about newness. And what's interesting is poem is just the little noun for a thing that has been made.
Hmm. Yeah, good.
And in English, we got that to mean a bunch of words that are novel and put together in a way that prose doesn't usually do. But actually behind that, it's just a made thing. So theopoetics is like the study of the ways the made things that humans make shape our understanding of God.
Okay, great. So I want to ask you then about something about this. So you are part of the Society of Friends, mm-hmm. and you've worked at places that are Baptist and Methodist and Catholic. So you're familiar with a lot of institutions, like institutional religion. When I hear theopoetics, I think about a certain kind of agility in how we articulate the experience of God. It requires us to be able to sort of articulate, then rearticulate and change our articulation to kind of respond to new information or new ways of imagining or conceiving of who God is. And that's great at a level of individuals. Do you find that theopoetics also informs, though, institutional religions and how they are able to articulate the experience of God? Is there enough deftness inside a massive institution that it can be as responsive theopoetically as can, say, smaller groups?
Yeah, I think about this in kind of two things come to mind. One is, I do think that there is some, there's a kind of at least two prongs in the theopoetics conversation that get picked up, even if people have never heard the term before, because of other qualities that people are used to in religious life. So, for example, one of them is embodiment and the importance of the body in religious experience. And I remember several years ago I was teaching, and at the end of my third week, one of my students came up to me and he said, you know, I really don't mean to be offending you by this, but everyone seems to think this is amazing and I don't get it. And I said, oh, what do you mean? And it turns out he was Orthodox, and none of this was new.
Okay.
Right? And so he was like, everyone else is really excited about what's going on in here and how they haven't heard this and that. And he says, but isn't this? And I was like, oh, no. Not everyone has kept the importance of the body and of the practices and of aesthetics. And so sometimes it's a reclamation practice. And he was like, huh, I guess I'm learning about myself by being somewhere else, right? So that's one part of the embodiment piece of it. I think the more that has a part of a presence and a recognition in a tradition, the more the theopoetics conversation is sensible. Sometimes to the point where it's so sensible that it doesn't even seem like it needs to be called anything other than just faith. The other thing that is very resonant is continuing revelation, the recognition that the spiritual gifts, in the Christian tradition at least, the spiritual gifts are kind of still poured out in the flesh, and how we can understand things about God's nature can continue to evolve. And that is true in my tradition and some other Christian traditions as well. And the more the awareness of embodiment as important and natural theology is important, and the fact that we can continue to learn, and so therefore tradition is itself a process as opposed to a fixed thing. Like, if you have those three things, when someone describes theopoetics to you, you go, oh yeah, that's what that word is, okay. But it's not really new, right? Whereas if any one of those things is absent in your tradition, when you learn about theopoetics, you're like, whoa, there's a thing. And that's partly because it's just the particular naming of those things coming together.
That's fascinating. You know, you say words like embodiment, and revelation that continues, you know, and I mean, you are speaking to the choir in a latter, from a Latter-day Saint perspective,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Because our traditions have a lot in common.
There is a lot in common. Yeah. It's really interesting that way, and you know, because both those things really resonate, you know, for us. But we don't use the term theopoetic. I think that we practice in my faith tradition a lot of things that would seem very evocatively theopoetic to you, but it's not a term that we use, even though you hear a lot of versions of what you do with theopoetics, I think, inside of our faith practice.
Yeah. Well, and I guess it's a long time ago now. Time happens funny in the classroom. But several years ago, I had an LDS student who was like, this is our theology.
Yeah.
And she was doing some incredible work kind of thinking about motherhood, and the ways in which that was relevant to it, and then tying it to the importance of an LDS kind of appreciation for what gets called eco-theology.
Yeah,
to saying, look, there's this other, these are these other traditions who have more formal theological training sometimes than a lot of some LDS folks. And she was just kind of doing incredible work, and the whole time through, it was like, oh, this is just like a coat that I know. It's just, you know, slightly a little different, but it's just my size.
Turn to your second book, the more recent one. This is 2 years old now. A book, I mean, I love both books. They're both great. This one, the title, Sense of the Possible, and subtitled An Introduction to Theology and Imagination. Right away, perhaps you could kind of address a reflex reaction that some listeners may have to the connection between theology and imagination. You know, saying they don't belong together because imagination means things that are fantastical and untrue. Although perhaps maybe a non-believer would say that's why they belong together, right? Because imagination, things that are fantastical, untrue, like any theology, et cetera, et cetera. As you point out, right, while the King James Bible, the translation of the Bible, does not appear to have much positive to say about imagination, right? A closer engagement of the text kind of reveals a different picture. Man, I'm curious what that picture actually is.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, well, first of all, if your listeners aren't sure about imagination and religion, I'm not sure exactly what they're,
right, yeah.
what they're listening for. But I do think more broadly, there's an awful lot of concern. And I can remember, like, you know, not hypothetical conversations, but I can remember being in conversations with, I wouldn't even call them colleagues, in circles, especially in some Southern Baptist trained circles where, like, and in neo-reformed circles where you really just can't trust anything unless it's the word of God, exactly the way that the scripture says it. And if you start talking about interpretation, they say there is no interpretation, you just need the Bible the way it is. And so in those spaces, when that's your kind of understanding of like how you make sense of the world, and if I'm being technically say, if that's your hermeneutic approach, well, there isn't really any room for imagination, right? And there are some places that, for example, will teach Bible, but then not teach interpretation. And teaching Bible is just like learning what the words say. And that's just simply not my position and my approach. And I think the scope of imagination is so broad, actually, that the problem is more that like it's involved in anything, in everything, as opposed to like, what's it doing here? And so one of the things that I say at a pretty basic level is like, if you're ever engaging with thoughts of the future, you're imagining it, right? And especially when you think about the particularities of sense, right? So the examples I often give kind of when I'm doing demos is like, if I just ask you to guess what tomorrow will be like, you'd be like, I don't know, probably be sunny. But I say, explain to me how tomorrow will be, and you engage a fuller sensorium, like it'll smell like this, and it'll eat like this, and you start talking about the things your body will do. It's much more imaginative than just guessing, which could be just verbal, mm-hmm. right? So part of what is happening in kind of the imagination is you're calling on these sense memories, and you're kind of assembling them in new ways to kind of imagine a future that hasn't arrived. And so once we realize that future is tied into imagination, well, what isn't tied into it?
Yeah, good. And you mentioned revelation. I would add there, right? You think about like the translation act that has to happen between like, you know, sort of some other world, you know, the world where God is and the world where we are, and the translation of one set of ideas into forms we understand would necessarily involve a lot of imagination. I mean, I think about like the Moses and the burning bush.
Yeah.
Right? You know, the burning bush, almost like a metaphor. This is a plant that's not quite plant-like. It's doing unplant-like things, but I'll get your attention by bringing attention to two things that don't belong together, mm-hmm. like bush and fire, unconsumed bush, to bring attention to a thing that's going to be also unthinkable, which is, hey, go liberate the children of Israel, right? Yeah. So that's imagination in act right there.
Yeah, and part of it, you know, this isn't directly tied to it, but increasingly I have been, and you heard it earlier in my kind of emphasis on embodiment, but, you know, I have really been struck, especially in the last few years, with the fact that in the Hebraic world that Jesus was a rabbi in, the word for heart, lev, was the seat of cognition and affect. So your mind and thoughts and feelings were the same place. And we weren't able to do that same separation that we can do once Paul's Greek and Hellenistic perspective came in. And that's part of the challenge of the Christian tradition, is like those texts and ideas don't always fit with each other
right.
well. And so there is this understanding, at least we have a pretty good hunch in Jesus, that when he talks about thinking and imagining in the future, you know, and things that have to require imagination, like the parables, right? The part of it is that our feelings and our thoughts are actually not split the way that we would think about them today, because Western Greek kind of philosophical traditions have skewed us from our bodies. And that isn't the same in the kind of Jewish worldview today even, but certainly not then.
Yeah, good. I even think about the way that, so my faith tradition, we tend to read the King James Bible. It's the one mm-hmm. that we read. And it's a beautiful translation, and there's all kinds of poetry and metaphor mm-hmm. in there. But what it doesn't allow people to see sometimes is kind of where the prose leaves off and the poetry begins. It actually changes genres.
Exactly.
And some genres bring attention to themselves as imaginative constructs, mm-hmm. as a way to kind of convey a point. And even to see the differentiation there sometimes in the scriptural text would reveal, right? Isaiah began speaking right there explicitly in poetry form. This must be then a different way of speaking from the previous passage.
Exactly. Right? Yeah, that's right. And I think that's partly why I think it's so important. Also because we know, or almost all traditions teach, that kind of God's ways are higher than our ways. And we know that God's fullness is going to be greater than ours. So the only way we're going to be able to apprehend that is not in any totality, but we imagine fractures. And in my tradition, we'll often talk about the inbreaking kingdom of God. And so you have a tiny moment of the inbreaking kingdom of God, and you have a sense of it. And then it goes away. But that doesn't mean it wasn't perfect in that moment, because God's time is outside of our time too. So we have to engage with the imagination. And whenever we try to have too close of a circle or too tight of a silo around our understanding of God, and then people, oh, but we don't really know. It's like, well, you act like you know.
That's right.
And so I like to emphasize that imaginative capacity, because there is potential fallibility to it. But I want to say is, of course there's fallibility to it. We're clay-footed people, and the best we can do with this creator God, which is so much bigger than us, is like grasp at these pieces and have these experiential moments where we have a fullness, but as much as fullness as we can handle on this side, a New Jerusalem.
yeah, good. Yeah, so I let our listeners know, I love your book on a couple fronts. It's a great primer on the development of the concept of imagination. So you go back to philosophers like, you know, Hume and Kant and poets like Coleridge, and then you take up theologians, lots of them, you know, Sally McFaig, Jamie Smith, others. It's really, really great on kind of development, showing how imagination becomes a central concept in Western thought, including religious thought,
yeah.
right? Which is great. But in addition to that conceptual history, you also address implications of why imagination is so important and how we live as Christians in the present.
Yeah.
Right. So you remark, for example, how imagination informs our practices of worship. Mm-hmm. But you add something really important, right, which is that worship is a broader category than religion alone, right? That worship pertains to the ways and the reasons why people gather and what they hold as ideal, mm-hmm. right? And this strikes me as especially portentous and, frankly, a little unsettling in our modern era, given how much fomenting political strife there is and the quasi-religious fervor around political leaders, right, that can liberate us or deliver us from times of tension and trial, not only in the U.S., but it's all across the Western world and beyond, right?
Absolutely.
Can you speak to that a little bit about imagination and worship in this broader unsettling sense?
Yeah, and I don't want to dodge politics at all, and I will move into one of the areas related to the study of imagination that is occupying a lot of my time these days, also not what I'm talking about at BYU, is the study of white Christian nationalism. So that is occupying a lot of my kind of thought spaces. But what I would say before we kind of move into the kind of political conversation is that one of the touch points for me on this specific question actually comes from a British theologian, a guy named Stephen Pattison, and he wrote a book, I think it was like 1997 or something like that, called The Faith of the Managers. And what he was doing is studying this kind of rise, and I don't know if you remember, if you were ever in that world, but like that kind of Stephen Covey management as a way of living and all these kind of philosophical sayings. And
Stephen Covey's from here, so
yeah.
Yes.
Right. So that world and that culture, Stephen was like, wait a minute. All these things that they say are sure things, like how strategic planning works, everyone knows it's not actually how it goes. You never follow that plan through, but everyone does the 10-step process and the three things, and you can switch. And he said, there's actually a kind of, I think he calls it a tacit religious identity. And he doesn't mean that there's literally like a management religion in a kind of doctrinal way, but the shape of the thing, which is that we do these practices which help us deal with the uncomfortable reality that like we're not sure what's happening, and it helps us ground us and it gives us practices and it helps us set up boundaries, like do you do it this way or do you do it that way. And he began to map from a practical theological perspective, which is my training, what if we treated what management culture was like as in fact an offshoot of a faith-based tradition, wouldn't we see some things? And sure enough, his argument was like, yep. But people get confused. Oh, so you think there's a religion of management? And he's like, no, this is analog, right? But I do think that that is really important because it shapes you, right? So from a formational lens, what happens is if that is the things that is kind of pointing you to what your concerns are and what you spend your time on and the way that you talk about that thing which is out of grasp, right? Then it has some shaping potential regardless of the fact that no one's identifying it as a religious practice. No one's saying a particular doctrine. But, you know, there are ways in which, like, we get taught and formed. And in some ways, we're just talking about culture. But some parts of culture gesture more significantly to the transcendent than others. And so I do think that that's worth recognizing. And I do think that kind of the faith of the managers is a kind of touchstone for me because it really reveals, or revealed to me at least, what is to be gained for those of us that are people of faith when we look at things that aren't strictly religious. So for example, look, I did my doctoral work focused on public schools, and it wasn't like secretly trying to smuggle in religion, but the reality is the American public school system cannot be understood without understanding its origins and the fights that happened around religion. And there are shapes, you know, listeners can't hear me here, but you kind of, you know the shape of a mountain, but then when it snows, it's not exactly the same, but you know what's underneath it. Right. Mm. Now imagine it snowed again and again and again and again and again. All of the contours would be sanded off. It'd be way smoother. But underneath it, you can kind of see why it got started. And that's how I think about a lot of these things, is like there are shapes in our practices, even when they're not religious, that have been informed by the philosophical and theological commitments that were there with the folks that founded them. And I think we need to pay attention to that because they shape us as sure as what happens on Sunday.
Yeah, you bet. Reminds me of an experience I had right as I was beginning grad school at UCLA in English, okay, way back in the days, like 30 years ago. And I had been studying in New York City, and I'd been reading very avidly a certain philosopher, you know, who was very popular back in the 1980s and 90s. And I remember getting to UCLA, and there was a special day of like orientation. And students who were in their second year and third year were taking us first year students around, like, here's the library, here's the department office, here's the bookstore, here's the, you know, kind of a thing. And one of the more experienced seasoned second years said, well, what are you working on? Who are you reading? What interests you? And I mentioned the name of this philosopher that, you know, very popular at the time. And he goes, oh, yes. He said, we all used to read that, but now we've moved on to other things. And as someone raised in a strong religious household, I heard that, we all used to, and now we all, I thought, man, inside there is some religious dogma that's hiding.
Yeah.
Right? It's a sense of the narrative about what we all do, who we all are, where we are going now, as not being anything explicitly religious. This was very, very secular, the mm-hmm. topic.
Yeah.
And yet it had a certain kind of energy to it that suggested you should do this, you should not do that. If you do the right things, there's a promise for you. Do the wrong things and you may get excluded in the grad program. It had a kind of a religious quality to that kind of imagination.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, the problem with any category, right, if everything is that and then nothing is that, because it's a useless kind of thought unit. So we don't want to say, well, everything can be kind of talked about as religion. So we can say, what do we mean? And for me, it has to do with like the things that orient our deepest longings,
mm-hmm.
right?
Good.
So we also see that in religion, right? Which is the, kind of the infighting and kind of ecumenism of who counts and who doesn't. Actually, both of our traditions, depending on who you ask, don't count as part of the Christian family, right? And there's reasons for that, right? And some of them are doctrinal, but a lot of them are cultural that we then put inside of doctrinal things, and people will say, well, that doesn't count because of this. Well, what about them? Well, that's different.
Right.
Yeah. Right. And so I think for me, the larger conversation that this is like circling around is the recognition that I take seriously that culture has an impact on our faith, and we shouldn't pretend that that's not the case. And it's not an oil and water thing. Culture is bad and church is good. Our church has been influenced by all kinds of political things that, quote, aren't the church. And the more we recognize that, the more that we can tend to asking, okay, that means probably not all of it is what we wanted to have done, but it's in our history, right? And so now what do we do? How do we envision the tradition, whatever it is, as something that's even closer to the best it always wanted to be, as opposed to just, let's just keep doing what we did. I talk about traditionalism as doing what's come before because it's come before. And I think that's idolatrous too.
Okay, good. So let me ask you on that subject then about that kind of use of imagination. You point out in the book, and I really appreciated this, that genuine spiritual growth almost always involves strain and struggle, inner turbulence, even some cognitive dissonance, as the Spirit brings to our awareness our shortcomings, the illusory nature, things we sometimes take to be true, the fear that displaces our faith in God, with a desperate clinging to political power, so on and so on. And I'm wondering what the role of imagination plays here. And I'm wondering, now this is kind of another both and question, but how is imagination different? There's an imagination that says, I can think and feel my way into what feels good, that feels like security.
Yeah.
Right? But there's also an imagination that says, I can be dislodged from what's secure toward what may be difficult, but probably is what God's calling me to be. And for you, is that the same faculty of imagination operating in two registers, or is there a different kind of a thing happening?
No, it's
in
the
there?
Same. And that's partly why, for me, discernment, and again, this is part of my tradition, but I think it's not just my tradition. It isn't an accident that I'm a member of the Religious Society of Friends, teaching at a Jesuit institution. We're the two traditions who most talk about discernment, because, my students often will roll their eyes at me, because at the end of the day, I go, well, that's what discernment's for, because that same faculty. And people sometimes resist this because there's a push, there is still a push to kind of valorize the imagination. Oh, the arts are important. Creativity is important. And I often encourage people to kind of learn about how really powerful art was used by the Third Reich. Mm-hmm. Phenomenal art made for heinous things. Does that make it bad art? And that's a separate artistic aesthetic question. But its relevance is to say, well, that's not really good art. And I go, I don't really know about that, right? So the point is, it's not always, if you try to make it so that imagination and creativity and aesthetics is always an inherent good, you have kind of like a true Scotsman fallacy, which is like, if it does something that you don't like, it's not good art. And I don't think that that's actually useful. Instead, we say, like lots of parts of the human life, this thing can swing either way. That's why it's so important we tend to our formation, that we tend to discernment, and we recognize the need for communities of practice. Because if I'm off on my own, who knows? You know, who knows what can happen there? And the images that kind of live in me and take hold may not be what is actually what's best for me or what I kind of understand God calling me to, but it will feel that way because our imagination is that powerful. And that's part of the kind of running theme in the book. You know, I'll always say to my students, I say at the beginning of every class for the first half of a semester, pretty much, I go, remember, if you leave with nothing else, there's no such thing as a lack of imagination. What you call a lack of imagination is simply the dominant imaginary calling itself all that real is.
Yeah, good.
Right? Because otherwise, they get real, and we all have to fight against real to be like, but also this. And instead, you go, no. That lack of imagination is very imagined. It's imagining that what is what always will be. But that's also an imagination.
Okay, yeah, good.
And as Christians, we have to always be on ready for what new God thing God might be doing, or that would be my recommendation at least.
Okay, good. Let me ask you this then, right? On the subject of this change, this reimagining new selves, right? This conversion, really.
Yeah, exactly.
You write something here, I'll quote you. You write that all spiritual formation is also imaginary formation. That is, helping people deepen in their spiritual lives will inherently entail changes in the stories, symbols, and experiences they reference to make meaning and find significance in their lives. All right. That rings very true to me. And I suppose I have two questions here. First, can you think of a case, whether in your own life or someone close to you, that proved to be especially true? And second, and this is kind of going more to the question I suppose I really have, how do you respond to the criticism someone might make that for all of our efforts to follow Christ, for all of our efforts to discern and become new creatures, that, you know, we don't finally change all that much. We're kind of hardwired for certain kinds of behaviors, dispositions, et cetera. And that in the eyes of some people, underneath it all, we remain the recognizably imperfect, unconverted people we've always been.
Well, let me take those in back. These are easy questions. Like, it's
yeah, no, that's, I specialize in those. Yeah, you know, so, sorry.
No, so let's take those backwards. So I would say, I think what I would say to the second question is we are always going to be these incomplete persons that we are. And the best that we can kind of hope is kind of movement towards. There's a kind of the immensity and the unfinished kind of work that God has for creation is, I think, present in our own work too, which is like, it is unfinished. And most of the people I've ever met who were like, no, I'm done. I'm all good now. I'm no longer clay footed. I've wiped that all off. I've replaced them. I don't know what's under that clay for them, but you know, that somehow they're all good. Hasn't been my experience of them actually. Right. And so part of it is about humility and the recognition that like there is a kind of a limit to what's possible. But on the other hand, it isn't just a humility, but a kind of recognition of the immense power and reality that is grace, that is so much larger than we can imagine, that as you continue to form and become increasingly kind of connected with kind of participants in God's nature and God's energies in the world, there's more there. And then there's more, and then there's more, and then there's more. And I think, you know, in Clement of Alexandria, kind of one of the early church fathers, actually uses the word theopoetics in Greek, and it's a kind of early synonym with theosis, which is the becoming godness. And it's not like there's going to be a bunch of gods running around, but that you can move yourself towards this kind of sanctified kind of moment in sanctification and kind of union with God. Not that you are Matt God, but that like you are more aligned, more fully connected with that direction. So I do think that it is the case that, you know, we are who we are, but that doesn't mean that we're not changing too. Because I think that what we are is a changing people. A lot of the stuff that comes behind both of these books for me is kind of like the building block is that I think it's important to attend to those noticings. Right, that we can get so patterned into our being that we don't notice the tiny little ways in which there are little pieces of kind of recognition of what's true. In my tradition, we talk about openings with a capital O. It's kind of like that way that I understand you all talk about whispers of the spirit, but it just happens. There's sometimes when you have this little moment and it's something has been opened to you.
Yeah.
And I think when you attend to that, you realize like, oh, there's a tiny way I could change, a tiny little way I could change. And I often concretize that with my students, especially when we do like theological reflection stuff, is I say, look, when you get to the end and you're trying to do this theological reflection exercise and you're like, how will you change because of it? It's not like every week you'd be like, and then I realized everything before now, I was a heathen and I was unrepentant and now I'm good. I said, if that happens every week, like, kudos to you. You know, that's great. But some of the best ones that I think are going to like have lifelong impact is when people talk about the tiny little things. The one I remember distinctly so much that I still teach it is someone was like, I realized that if I took an extra 2 seconds every time I was at the grocery store to really see the humanity of the person who's checking me out, they and I would both have a better day.
Nice.
Tiny, 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 tiny little thing, right? But now they're bringing the fullness, and I would say their God-given fullness in that moment at the register to say, hey, I see you. I hope you're having a great day. Instead of just like, all right, thanks, go. And it just becomes transactional. Now some fullness of people engages with one another. And like, if they're still doing that, there's no question in my mind that that has had more impact on their life than a thought they thought and did nothing with.
That's nice. I like that a lot. Tell me this rings true to you as it does in my own experience. My experience is about discernment of the spirit and seeking to sort of access, you know, kind of the wisdom of mm-hmm. the spirit and in embodied situations in real life. I find that when there is that kind of familiarity with the spirit or access to it, it opens new channels in us. It forms some kind of new groove. And even if we can't fully live into a fully realized version of ourselves, there's nonetheless something open in a way where you say, well, you know, I want to develop this. I want to come back to this. There's a deeper way I can feel for others. There are new ways to think about some situation. And it's not that it's going to sort of transform you in the moment, but it's incremental. And over time, right, it becomes noticeable and can be quite dramatic.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's right. And I don't even really think of it as like, I don't think the category of fully realized is even a thing. That like there's is fully realized as the fulliest realized person on the planet is, that person will be more fully realized tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow. So then for us, the category of full is actually not helpful. What we want to do is come closer and closer to our understanding of kind of what God wants in the world. And then to kind of do that, I think in a way that doesn't kind of move into madness, we have to do that with each other, right? So one of the things, I think about a lot with my daughter. She's 15. And, you know, one of the things that we talk about a lot, she's the daughter of two ministers. And so she kind of came up, you know, in a house that was like very intensely kind of formative. And she knows her Bible really well. And she knows our tradition really well. And what we talk about is, you know, why do we tell the old stories? Like, we don't just tell them like it's the same. We don't learn them for the same reason we learn the periodic table or physics. But like partly the reason we learn them is because we're the kind of people that learn them. And that's not the only reason, but like there's something about us having the shared language, which is how we imagine the world and how we talk about the world. And because we talk about the world in a particular way, and like this conversation is like, there's enough of an overlap between the way my tradition and your tradition talks over the world. Like we could have a different kind of conversation than if you were a Catholic or a reform person, because we have some shared understandings, but I can't map it out. The doctrine isn't the same, but there's a feel for the way that God works in the world that my tradition has that is partly formed because we know the stories. We've told the stories, you've told your stories, and there's some shared realities between them, and we live into them. You know, that's the other part about imagination that I think people, it's so important. Some of those things that are false imaginings become real, right? So, you know, I often talk about this because a dear friend of mine who was raised at my age, but was kind of raised in a place in a time was like, you're not going to go to college and women aren't professionals. And she said, I think women can do that. But she on her own without support was like, and is now a bioinformatic science person at a at a tech firm in Germany, but like essentially on her own was like, I'm gonna go to tech school, I'm gonna learn how to code, I'm gonna learn all this kind of stuff. But for every one of her, there's a bunch of people who are like, oh, I guess women don't do that. And so then this false imagining that that's what women are becomes true. So that's partly why I think it's so important that we attend to this, which is in some ways just culture, but it's more than that, because actually it constricts or expands what is possible, right? That's why it's called Sense of the Possible, is it actually changes what you think tomorrow can be, and then tomorrow's tomorrow, and then next year, and then a decade. And for those of us that are people of faith, we need to allow ourselves to envision the fullness of kind of what God would want, which is going to be so much bigger than what we can do by default, that we have to attend to the other things that are trying to push on us and tell us that they know what the future will be.
Talk to you about one of the concepts you share in the book. It's an important one, the idea of the Overton window, right? And this is, as you explain this in the book, it's the range within which new ideas are acceptable to us. If you go kind of too far, it could be too far one direction or another direction, we kind of say, that's impossible, that's unthinkable, I can't even get my head around. That's you know, either it's hogwash or it's impossible, right? So that there's something about the Overton window, which is like the sweet spot for how we receive new things. Now, I can think of examples in Scripture, okay, in the Bible, Hebrew and Christian Bibles, where, you know, kind of Isaiah has a vision, you know, in the temple. That strikes me as being kind of like, whoa, way outside the normal bounds,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But then I can think about like Jesus calling the disciples and saying, I'll make you fishers of men, mm-hmm. where it's like, oh, fishers, that's I get that concept. It's very familiar. It's acceptable, right? Mm-hmm. Both those things seem operative, one way outside the boundaries, the other inside. Can you explain a little bit again about that window then, what that is, and how you see, like in your tradition, when there are openings, mm-hmm. do you find that they fall within the range of the acceptable, or do they pull your imagination in some new radical direction?
Yeah. So let me first say that, you know, my use of the Overton window, which comes straight out of political science, is probably a stretch for the way that like political scientists would use it. So
fair enough.
I just want to kind of mark that.
But I'm a literature guy, so I stretch everything.
Great. Right?
So, okay.
We're in good company here, Matt. So when I talk about the Overton window, one of the things that I think is important kind of is the visual, right? So if you imagine that there's a kind of a 10-foot field in front of you, and there's a window in the middle of it that covers 2 feet. So that means, you know, on either side, there's a bunch of stuff that isn't in the window. And what everyone thinks is possible is in the window. Now, the Overton window is about policy. And the way you know what policy is because you look at the law. It's a little different when you're talking about culture, because there's already some fuzziness. So the metaphor is already breaking down. But you go, there's different ways you could do it. You can either move the window itself to the left or the right, and things that were formerly in a field that was inconceivable is now in the window because you moved the window to the right. But you can also stretch the window and make the window wider or make the window narrower so that what's possible gets narrower and narrower, or what you can imagine is possible is wider and wider. But you know what? The field's there either way. It's just a matter about whether you think it's possible or not. So in kind of theological and Christian spaces, and I think one of the reasons literature is so important, because it's one of the ways that this happens routinely, I say, if you are doing some prophetic work at the far edge and you are yelling at the far edge of the field, hey, over here exists, everyone goes, huh, that seems really far away and impossible, Isaiah. But then maybe there's some movement towards Isaiah. So let's say it's a, whatever you already said, it was a 10-foot field there. Well, maybe the window moves like a foot towards him, right? And then everyone's like, well, that's not enough. He said over here exists, and it's all the way at 10, and we just moved from 5 to 6. Well, if you listen to the pragmatists, if you listen to, and I don't mean philosophical pragmatists, but people who can want to say, oh, well, I'm pragmatic, I don't want to do all this big, you know, pie in the sky stuff. You're like, what we really need to do is get loud prophetic people to speak from the 7-yard line and go, hey, over here. But the problem is then you only move 1/10 of 1 yard. Mm-hmm. Right, so you sometimes need that prophetic voice to speak for the impossible future towards which we orient, right? Because if we don't have that, then what will seem impossible becomes increasingly like minute. And then it's hard for us to move at all. But what's hard is you have to know that in God's sight, that thing you're proclaiming at the far edge of what is possible. And you have to recognize the movement of society to that is unlikely to go immediately. So that's the way I think about it prophetically. And from a theological tradition, that tends to be the difference between liberation theology and public theology, which are the two specializations that I have. So the liberation tradition will always demand that the perfect be named, and that anything short of it is the church failing to be all that it could be. And then the public theologians go, yeah, but then you're not going to get people on board because you need to talk about what to do tomorrow. Right. So I live in between those two worlds. And in my tradition, one of the ways that we have always done this is that when someone has a sense of what is true, they bring it to their congregation, to their meeting community. And if the meeting agrees that it is true, then they will send that person to another congregation and say, hey, we discovered that God gave us something new. Do you guys think that's true here? And then if so, you keep traveling. And then maybe that congregation also sends other people out because they discovered this truth. So in the earliest form of the traveling ministry in the Religious Society of Friends, the thing that all the traveling ministers took with them was what we called a query. And we didn't bring particular teachings. We brought questions and we asked people to worship with those questions and see what God gave them. Mm. And the first query, other than who's died and who's been born, which was the first one, is, can you tell me how truth is prospering here? Mm. Which is a kind of organic horticultural metaphor way before French analytic thought in the 1900s. This is in the 1660s. And what would happen is people in that congregation would be like, well, God gave us this and we think this is true and this is giving us great life. And then that minister would say, I'm so glad to hear what God is doing in your midst. And they'd stay on the road and they'd be like, hey, I was just here. Can I tell you about what God is doing there and what truth is being grown? And they go, oh, we didn't know they were doing that. And then they might send a minister back there to find out how they, and so it always went ground up. It never went ground top down. And in fact, we don't even have mechanisms for things to go top down. It always goes from the individual to the community, to the community, to the broader community, to the broader community up. There's no mechanism to go the other direction.
That's really interesting. That would be an interesting conversation to have on some points of similarity and difference between our two faith traditions, but that's a really, really great explanation. Thank you so much for this, Cal. This is a great conversation. I've got time for one more question to ask you. So at the conclusion of your book, you write that Christianity in the United States is in a precarious moment, right? And you mention in the book January 6th and the rise of Christian nationalism as an example. We should know, we'd be remiss not to know, that recording this interview less than a week after the activist and organizer Charlie Kirk was assassinated at a nearby university, it's about 4 or so miles from here. And that incident feels like yet another flashpoint for how we respond as a society and as Christians. As you weigh the events of the past few years, or even the past few days, do you find yourself hopeful about where we're headed? Does the imagination either of our broader society and nation or of a critical subset in it strike you as being properly attuned for maybe a better outcome than maybe we might envision otherwise?
I don't know as if I can unequivocally talk about hope other than kind of in spiritual or theological terms, which is to say my commitment is that yes, there is some other greater thing and all things can be reconciled unto God. But practically speaking, the place that my hope hits the ground, I sometimes will talk about a material hope or like a critical hope, is a realization, especially as I've been studying kind of Christian nationalism these last few years, is that some of the most heinous stuff that gets done in the name of Christianity that I would not identify with the teachings of Jesus is a function of abstraction. That is to say, people don't know their neighbors. They know what national news or what the algorithm has given them as a replacement for national news says, and they read everything through that instead of the other way around. So with the decline of local news, with the decline of social things that are connected. People know each other in the market, or people know each other because they use each other's services. You know, I'm a cobbler and you need your shoes fixed, or, you know, as things have changed and everyone can get buy things from their chair at home and click and it gets delivered and they don't know the delivery person, everything can become silos of individualism. Then when you think about the world you're in, this is why imagination, I'd say, is important. What you think the community is around you isn't always even what it is.
Right.
It's what the news you've been, quote unquote, news you've been consuming tells you it is. And so I don't think that we can trust the mechanisms of learning about ourselves as a country, because behind almost all of them, and increasingly this is happening, there's a profit motive, right? So it's not convenient to talk about the ways in which we have things in common. In literally, it doesn't drive sales. It doesn't drive ad revenue. It doesn't keep you on TikTok. What keeps you on TikTok, what keeps you on Shorts, what keeps you on Threads is enragement and a feeling like no one gets me, or I can't believe those idiots did X, Y, and Z, right? And the more they can get people scrolling, the more they can get people engaging, the more ads they can show, and the more the wealthy can get wealthier. And we continue to not know each other. And so to the extent that I have hope, it is about the ways in which our communities of Christians can help each other and the communities of folks who are not our community, but are live in our proximity, can get to more greatly understand the actual material, like life that we live, and not just see it through the lens of what we've been told by the people who want to keep us enraged so they can continue to make money off of us.
Yeah, that's great. You know, the way that our communities are organized in my faith tradition, where you live geographically will determine where you can worship, right? Where you, I mean, not you, you can go wherever you want, but where you're going to belong, especially in church records, is a function of geographic location. And what that means is that because you have no choice about where you go, it throws people with very different points of view into the same worship space. And when I see people from different positions on issues being forced to do difficult things in the name of their faith and religion, things they would not otherwise do, just given their own proclivities politically for one side or the other, I think to myself, that's good.
Yeah.
That's necessary. I'm grateful for that. I guess that gives me some hope in people's capacity to do difficult things, even if you don't see that publicized broadly.
Yeah. And I think, for example, and, you know, this is just a function of I think some of the great strengths of the LDS Church is what's happened on the left is an assumption that conservative Christianity is Christian nationalism. It's not true. There's a lot of conservative Christian folk, including a lot of members of your tradition, who aren't nationalists. But now they're hard packed to know where to go because the people in power who identify with the Christian nationalism are like, you either are or you're not really conservative.
Right.
So once again, we've hollowed out any capacity for bridge building. And one of the things that I will often say to my kind of conservative and progressive colleagues is like, look, we have to make it okay to be a conservative Christian in this country without thinking that conservative Christians are always going to be interested in Christian nationalism. If we don't allow for that category to exist and be robust, well, then everything's going to seem bad. A lot of folks who are very deeply Christian don't like what's going on, but it's not really clear where they get to fit because the narratives of what it means to be conservative in this country has become this kind of weaponized Christian vision. And we have to do some work across difficult political gaps to figure out how to like right that wagon. And it's going to be tricky because it doesn't mean we're going to agree doctrinally or socially, but we can agree that some of this other stuff is craziness and definitely not what God would want. And we have to figure out how to do that bridging work because it's, I don't believe in a kind of, a satanic power that like plots and makes people do things in a kind of like evil mustache on the, like, yes, I'm making, like, I don't do that. But in my tradition, we talk about the confounder. And I do think there are cultural norms that are making us split from each other deeper and deeper and deeper. And for those of us that are Christian, regardless of where we are on the kind of political spectrum, I do think that part of what we're called to is to like really know each other and know each other in that which is eternal, because we'll realize that those divisions don't add up to much, kind of given what God is calling us to.
May that prove true. Thank you so much, Khaled, for your wisdom and your work. It's great to have you here at BYU and great to have you on the podcast.
Yeah, I'm excited to be here and got to see you in the flesh after listening to your voice for quite a while.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith and Imagination podcast. This podcast is sponsored by the Faith and Imagination Institute, the BYU Humanities Center, and the College of Humanities at Brigham Young University, and is produced and edited by Kate Thorpe. The music for this podcast is composed by Ethan Wickman and is performed by Nicholas Phillips on Albany Records. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review on your podcast platform. And if you're interested in other episodes, check out our website at humanitiescenter.byu.edu. Thanks again for listening.